Good evening. We're thankful for all who are here tonight. We're going to be involved in a study that might be a little more unique or a little different here. We have some who may be soon making a trip to Greece, making their way out there. And one place that could well be visited would be the city of Corinth. And so, in light of that, and also because for our midweek class, we have been looking at 1 Corinthians. We've just started there in 1 Corinthians. I thought it might be helpful to look at Paul and his work at Corinth. Look at biblical archaeology and what has been found over at Corinth. And I'm going to be sharing some pictures that I was able to take, photographs that I was able to take from a trip that I made several years back. And I hope that in some way we can bring the biblical world to life for all of us here. Now, Corinth was a well-known city in ancient Greece, and there would have, in fact, been quite a few times in which the population for the city of Corinth would have exceeded the population for, say, Athens, which was the chief city, the main capital city there for the Greek people. And so it was a well-known city, and Corinth was extremely wealthy based upon its location in the Greek world. As they say there with real estate, it's all about location, location, location. And so when you look there at where Corinth was situated, it was there upon what is known as, now here's a bigger word, an isthmus. Isthmus. Now try saying that 10 times. I-S-T-H-M-U-S. An isthmus. There you're looking at a narrow neck of land, a narrow strand of land that separates two bodies of water, and it also connects two larger bodies of land. Now, why is that significant here? Why is that important? And how did that contribute to Corinth becoming so fabulously wealthy? Well, you see, if you were in the business of trade, and of course, when you look at an economy, trade is a big deal, buying and selling goods. The economy is largely dependent upon it. And so as you would be exchanging goods domestically and also abroad, it would be in your interest to find certain seaports for docking that would help your journey and speed your journey along. And so you can just think about this now as you would have merchants that would come from east to west or west to east. They would often want to take a shortcut right over here at Corinth. Because if they did not do that, then they were facing the foreboding task of having to travel an additional 200 miles around this huge tract of land that was known as the Peloponnesus since ancient times. And so they said, look, We have to be watchful for our time. Time is money, and money is time. It is that way today. It was that way back then. And so they would often opt for this shortcut over here, where they would offload their goods and then load those goods onto another boat. Or sometimes, now get this, even historically what was done, sometimes, because they had the engineering capabilities to do this, they would literally take a ship, they would take a boat, and move it across the land and deposit it on the other side so that that ship could go on its merry way with its cargo. Well, now, whenever you have those type of dealings, you're going to have taxes. You're going to have fees that you have to pay. And so, in that way, Corinth became just extravagant there with her wealth, enormously wealthy. And it was a bustling commercial center. Now, by the time that Paul had arrived here, in what is thought to be about 51 AD, Corinth already had a very long and storied past. And the city of Corinth would have featured very prominently in Greek religious life. Just like you could say, for a parallel, the city of Jerusalem featured very prominently in Jewish religious life. Now, of course, when you're talking here about Greek religion, you're looking there largely at mythology, but they had a whole backstory behind this establishment of Corinth. And so, for instance, even there in Paul's time, in Paul's day, there would have been stories told about Jason and the Golden Fleece, and how Jason later became involved with the royal house of Corinth. And just as you would talk about, say, parallels between different cultures there for the Genesis flood story, a Genesis-type flood story, so too, I think, when you look here at this one about Jason and the Golden Fleece, you see some striking similarities. It bears a striking resemblance to the story there in the Bible about Abraham and how it was that he ended up sacrificing a ram with its horns caught in the thicket in place of his son Isaac. And that, for me personally, brings out how it was that not only was Abraham a very wealthy person, but he was very well known even in ancient times. And so it seems that stories about Abraham started to stretch on into other cultures as well. And of course, with those other cultures or those other sectors of people, they would have altered some of the details. But now, be that as it may, you could also think back to another story here that would have been well known in the time of Paul. And that would have been about Oedipus. Oedipus. He was the king of Thebes who had been raised from infant to adulthood in the city of Corinth. And there had been a prophecy here, according to them, that he would ultimately kill his father and marry his mother. And as the story goes, he tried to avoid that fate, but like a pawn in a chess game, he got swept up along with all of this here and was moved by some inexplicable forces. And so he became guilty of this atrocity. And when his wife discovered that this happened to be her long-lost son, her new husband was also her long-lost son, she went and hung herself for shame connected with that. And when Oedipus discovered that he had unknowingly married his mother, the story goes that he plucks out his own eyes and becomes a wanderer in the earth. Gross, disgusting, R-rated to be sure. But these were the stories that became connected with Corinth and the Greek people. They are made popular by movies and books today. Sigmund Freud, incidentally, had a lot to say about Oedipus and the Oedipus complex that he had termed and described a bizarre theory, which we don't have to get into. Corinth was very strong militarily. In fact, they had started to produce in mass warships. The very first sophisticated warship, which was known as the trireme, it was outfitted with a ram up there on the prow. And so here they could just charge right into other ships and sink them, sink their battleships that way. The very first naval battle in all of world history, according to a lot of experts here, would have been right here with the Corinthians. They took on their rival, Corcyra, in the year 433 BC. But you see, as they were producing these warships in mass and selling them to their allies and selling them all over, again, they began to increase their wealth all the more. They had a well-known helmet that became a standard all over Greece. Now, we look at this helmet here. It's known as a Corinthian helmet, but the ones that really started to make it very iconic would have been the Spartans. The Spartans, who are known there for their ferocity and their warlike features. And of course, we think also of Michigan State today is connected there with the Spartans. That was a Corinthian helmet. The Athenians also adopted it too. As far as architecture goes, let me go ahead and say this. Now, whenever you would have a dig, an archaeological team go out to a particular area, and they break new ground and they uncover new flooring that they hadn't really discovered before, almost immediately, they look for columns. They look for pillars. Now, you could be talking about, say, temple grounds, or perhaps a pavilion, wherever it was that people would meet and people would get together. And they have basically classified columns in three different ways. They talk about Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian. All right, technical, I get that. But now where am I going with this? All right. When you have the students of world history approach all of this, they make assessments, they make conclusions based upon the architecture of a given people. So for instance, the Spartans were a Doric people. Now what can you tell here just as you look at the Doric column? It's very plain. It's very simple. It's not elaborate at all. It's not fancy. And so, as you think there about the Spartans, why, they're all about war. They're all about doing battle with each other or with other people. And so they weren't going to be wasting much time with art and beauty. But now, on the other hand, when you look over here at the Corinthian column, what stands out? Oh, it's like up here at the top, we've got like a beautiful flower. They were very refined and sophisticated, cultured. All right? Now let me ask you this. Which of these columns would be the most expensive to produce? I think you got it right over here, the Corinthian. So you see, the archaeologists make determinations now, and they know that based upon this reality here, that the Corinthians possessed, as a city, a lot of money. Very lucrative as a group of people. Let's talk about Paul's connection here. He comes in about that year 50-51 AD, and from Corinth he wrote 1st and 2nd Thessalonians and Galatians, it's thought to be. He stays there about a year and 6 months, according to Acts chapter 18 there, verse 11. Now from there he would head over to Ephesus, and then down on into Jerusalem, and then up north from Jerusalem up to Antioch, and from Antioch he would go back to Ephesus. And from Ephesus, what would he pen? He would pen the letter known as 1 Corinthians. He was staying there 3 years in Ephesus. He writes 1 Corinthians, it's thought, towards the end of his stay there in Ephesus, about 56 or 57 AD. Now let me go ahead and show you Corinth here, if I might. As you would come to Corinth, as you would be there on a tour bus, and you're making your way over here to the city, the ancient city, you would be met by a large hill there in the distance. And the guide will refer to this as Acrocorinth. That's a bigger term, but it basically means the highest point of the city. Now, when we got over here, the weather was not great. In fact, it would start to rain a bit. And so it was a little eerie showing up here. And when you look at the summit here, when you look at the top of this hill over here, it almost seems as though perhaps it's scraping a cloud, or at least it's a little foggy up there. But up there at the very top, Acrocorinth here, you would have had here a temple to Aphrodite, the goddess, the Greek goddess of love and beauty. And an ancient historian by the name of Strabo refers to how there are about 1,000 temple prostitutes, temple harlots, to the goddess Aphrodite, right up here. And I tell you what, as I think about what Paul has to emphasize here with the church at Corinth, he wastes little time in getting to the topic of sexual purity, correct? In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, there in verse 12. Now this is after he'd already pointed out that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God. And he encourages them not to be deceived. Don't be short-sighted here. Don't be influenced by the world to think that all of these moral issues are just insignificant or minor. No, that's not the case at all. And so he has this to say here in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, there in verse 12. All things are lawful for me, but all things are not helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any. Now look here at verse 13. Foods for the stomach, and the stomach for foods, but God will destroy both it and them. It seems here in this particular part that he's making a commentary on a rather common phrase there among the Greek people, yes, even there at Corinth. That the idea was that just like Our tummies are pretty well geared to hold food, hold some carbs, all of that there, the goodies. All right. Then, all things being equal as far as they viewed it, we're, quote, sexual creatures. And so, hey, it's all very natural, just like eating food, you see. You can go ahead, if you're attracted to this person over here, you can go ahead and engage them in a very sensual way. Now, yes, we understand we are as, quote, sexual creatures, but that has its place. That has a context there. That's within marriage. But you see, to the Corinthians, they just said, oh, we're going to cast all that part aside right there and just go for the gusto. And let's just live in pleasure. Well, Paul has to deal with all of this here. He says, now the body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. We're set apart to God. And God both raised up the Lord and will also raise us up by His power. Now watch verse 15. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of what? Members of a harlot? Certainly not. And you had over here on the summit 1,000 harlots. Don't forget, too, that we're looking here at a seaport city. What did you have there at seaports? You had sailors. And unfortunately, what would often accompany a sailor's life would be there's some debauchery. All right? Prostitution undoubtedly turned out to be quite big business out over here at Corinth. And so you can see how Paul is time and again here in 1 Corinthians emphasizing the need to be set apart to God and holy unto God. Even long before the time of Paul, they had a pretty low reputation. Aristophanes here, who lived long before Paul, had coined a phrase, to live as do the Corinthians. That was no compliment. Plato here, long before Paul, talked about a Corinthian girl as being one and the same as a prostitute. Now, that is no badge of honor to wear for your city, for your namesake there. If you're up there on the top, there's not much that remains today from the temple of Aphrodite, but you can get a remarkable view down below. And from the top there, you can get a good gander at ancient Corinth. And what stands out the most here would be the columns here of the temple of Apollo. The temple of Apollo. And I'm going to go ahead and show you this here now. This is just a fraction, just a mere fraction of what had originally existed. And so you can see over here that in dark blue, you have these dots which show you where the pillars and columns are today, forming like this corner over here. But they do not possess any of the others, and they can show you here approximately how large this temple to Apollo was. Now, who was Apollo? All right. Greek mythology is not everybody's cup of tea. I get that part. Well, he would have been the god of the sun. And the Greeks were very fond of worshiping the sun. Now, they had actually several gods that were characteristic of the sun, but Apollo happened to be the primary and principal god of the sun. Now, that name sounds a little like what? There's a biblical name that I'm sure we're familiar with. Apollos. Apollos. And who was Apollos? He was a mighty preacher, very eloquent with his words and his speech. And you know how it was that he was converted over there at Ephesus, and ultimately the brethren would write over to Corinth, exhorting and encouraging the disciples there to receive him. And when he makes his way over there to Corinth, he speaks very boldly and mightily in the name of the Lord Jesus. And many disciples are won because he vigorously refutes the Jews that are there. He was so effective that what do we know as we come there to the book of 1 Corinthians? A party started to develop around him, right? And people were saying what? Some were saying, I am of Apollos. All right? Well, you look at that name there. It sounds a lot like Apollo. And so you could well conclude then that potentially his parents were pagan. They were idolaters possibly, and gave him there that name. after the sun god. But as he comes here over to Corinth and sees a temple which is very much like his name, a temple to Apollo here, he would be preaching out against going there to that temple. Make no mistake that he would have laid eyes upon it. What you see over here, he would have laid eyes upon this structure, as would the Apostle Paul himself. And as Paul spoke out against Christians going here to this house of false worship, so too would Apollos do the same, undoubtedly. In 1 Corinthians chapter 8, you can see here how some questions, very practical questions, had begun to develop there within the local church at Corinth, centering around meat that had been sacrificed to idols. In 1 Corinthians chapter 8, there in verse 10, he says, "For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple," you see, Paul would have had in mind what you see right up here with this picture. Much like it, you see. "If anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? And because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died." In other words, he's going to go into it wholesale, not understanding the boundaries here. "But when you thus sin against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never again eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble." Now, as far as the eating of that meat, Paul understood, and he describes how it is that we're looking here at a personal liberty. If you can do that in private, you can do that in private there. But now, what about that question of going into the temple itself? That's a different issue altogether. And so he says here in chapter 10, verse 14, "Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak as to wise men. Judge for yourselves what I say." And he talks here about the Lord's Supper that's there in the Lord's house, the church. "The cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ?" And he says here, verse 18, "Observe Israel after the flesh. Are not those who eat of the sacrifices partakers or sharers of the altar?" You see, we're endorsing here the death of Christ. And also, we're proclaiming the Lord's death till he comes. And so we're underscoring how Christ is going to come back. If we take of this sacred feast, that is the message we are unmistakably sending to all others. And so he makes a correlation, a connection. Do not be naive here to think that you can go into this house of corrupt pagan worship and come out clean. He says, "What am I saying then? That an idol is anything, or what is offered to idols is anything? Rather, that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and the table of demons." So you're going to have to choose one or the other. You go to church services, not here to the house of Apollo. All right. Well, not far from the temple grounds there, you would have had the marketplace. The marketplace. And we were able to look around there and step around. And what also jumps out at me is quite striking is that as you come there into the marketplace, you have a section there where you would have had what would be considered booths, little quarters here, where it would be that people would be selling their goods. And I think there about Paul. By occupation, he was what? Tent maker. Together with who? Aquila and Priscilla. Somewhere here, not far, we would be looking at the very location, the very place where Paul had set up shop to sell the leather, to sell the goods, right? Where exactly, we'll never know, but somewhere here. Now, there was another question here that centers around all of this. What about that meat that had been there in the marketplace? It's removed from the temple. Can we purchase this? Is this an endorsement of false religion? Well, he says here, Chapter 10, verse 25. Eat whatever is sold in the market, the meat market, asking no questions for conscience sake. You see, because meat is just meat. The earth is the Lord's in all its fullness. But now look, here's a qualification, a clarification. Verse 27. If any of those who do not believe invites you to dinner and you desire to go, eat whatever is set before you, asking no question for conscience sake. But if anyone says to you, oh, this was offered to idols, what are you going to do now, huh? You're going to eat that? You're going to put that in your mouth? Do not eat it for the sake of the one who told you and for conscience sake. For the earth is the Lord's in all its fullness. Conscience, I say, not your own, but that of the other. For why is my liberty judged by another man's conscience? In other words, we don't want to let our good be evil spoken of. And so do not be as a stumbling block to those whom you're trying to reach and teach with the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. He's encouraging Christians to look there at a bigger picture. But over here in the marketplace, what you're looking at is where you would have had that very meat sold and distributed. We went to a place here where they had collected a lot of the artifacts. They're statues that date back to the time of Paul, round about there, some earlier, some a little later. But the most significant find to me was this block right up over here. Now, what do you see there on that block? Can you make out a menorah? The Jewish candlestick, right? As scholars look at all of this here, they've understood this then to be a marker stone, like a signpost, indicating that over here at this particular place, you had a Jewish house of worship, also known as what? Also known as a synagogue. Now, with this stone that they found here, over there at Corinth, all right, they've been able to conclude that that stone had been moved. How and when, they don't quite know. But it was not there in its original location. But had they been able to uncover the original location of that stone, now let this part sink in here. Might bake the noodle. If they had found that original location, then guess what? You would have also discovered the approximate location for where the early church at Corinth met. How do we know about that? Because you go over here to Acts chapter 18. Acts chapter 18, right? It says there in verse 7, and he departed from there and entered the house of a certain man named Justus, one who worshipped God, whose house was next door to the synagogue. Verse 8, then Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his household, and many of the Corinthians, hearing, believed and were baptized. So you see, very near to that synagogue, you would have had the church assembling and meeting. That stone for the signpost is over there today. And of course, too, it's a reminder that when Paul came to a new location, a new place, always without fail, he was looking for that house of worship, the Jewish house of worship. And so even there in Acts chapter 18, verse 4, it tells you he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded both Jews and Greeks. Could it well be that Paul had laid eyes on a stone like this? And over there in that museum, again, you can see quite a few artifacts that have been uncovered and unearthed in the soil out there. They even have, look at this right here, a Corinthian helmet. As Paul was there, he got into trouble. Surprise, surprise. Characteristic of his work and the preaching that he was doing with the intensity. So he was called before the government, correct? He was called to give an account here. Well, the Jews wanted him to answer. They wanted him to face the music. But I want you to take a look at this over here, if you might. Now, what do we have over here? I don't know that you can make this out. You probably cannot. But you have the letters B-E-M-A. It's over here on this particular wall, all right? B-E-M-A. Do me a favor here and go to Acts 18. Take a look here at verse, let's see here. Acts chapter 18. It tells you there in verse 12, when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews with one accord rose up against Paul and brought him to where? Brought him to the judgment seat. You read it? I trust that you do. All right. Let your gaze go over to your cross references. Maybe your middle column. Do you see there, for that verse, verse 12, the letters GR, period, meaning Greek? All right. What's this in the Greek? There you have our letters. B-E-M-A. Bema. The judgment seat. This happens to be one of the most surest spots that Paul would have been. He was brought right over here as a trial was about to ensue. And it would be over here at the judgment seat that you would have had different lawyers and attorneys get up and try to make a case or try to persuade people. There would have been water pots that would have been set out here. So these functioned as clocks to give each speaker a set amount of time. To my knowledge, there is no known bust or reflection of Gallio today. But his well-known brother was Seneca, and yes, there are marble statues of him. All of that took place right over here. And last but not least here, you have a stone here that's referred to as the Erastus Stone, the Erastus inscription. You have here carved within it, you're going to have to take my word for it, Erastus. That V would have served as a U, but you're looking here now primarily at the Latin, which is the language of the Roman people, which happened to be very prevalent there for the city of Corinth, a Greek city, but yes, the Romans had control there. All right, Erastus. What do we know about Erastus, if in fact a connection can be made here? We know that he is referred to no less than three times within the New Testament. But I call your attention over to Romans chapter 16. Romans 16, there in verse 23. Romans 16, 23. What do we know about Erastus? Now, Paul, as he writes Romans, is understood to be writing from the city of Corinth. And what does he say here in Romans chapter 16, verse 23? Gaius, my host and the host of the whole church, greets you. Erastus, the treasurer of the city, greets you. All right? So he was a bit of a bookkeeper over there, a high-profile man. He had an important job. He was there working with the banks, as it were. He was the treasurer of the city there at Corinth. And you know what is somewhat remarkable about this? Is that when you look here at this stone that's over there, the inscription reads, Erastus, the director of public works, bore the expense of this pavement. Could we not be looking at the very same Erastus that was a Christian, a child of God, with all of this here? It was very wet, very rainy. But I'm standing here on the Lycaon Road, which would have been the road that Paul himself would have traveled over and over again there at Corinth. We came to Cenchrea. Why is Cenchrea special? Well, Paul had taken a vow here, had his head shaved, correct? But also there was a strong worker for the Lord, Phoebe by name. Right there in Romans chapter 16, what does Paul say about her? A special woman, very resourceful, very talented. I commend to you, verse 1 of chapter 16, I commend to you Phoebe, our sister, who is a servant of the church in Cenchrea. About 9 miles outside of Corinth, as you would head out east, you would find Cenchrea. Evidently, there was a church right over there. And so we were privileged to visit Cenchrea and look around. I used a bigger word. Corinth was established on what again? An isthmus. All right, now, where am I going with this? Corinth was also well known for the Isthmian Games. The Isthmian Games, which had as a counterpart the Olympic Games. Where did the Olympic Games go on? There at the base of Mount Olympus, right? But the Isthmian Games happened over here at Corinth. And we have some of the starting blocks that runners would have used, the starting point for their races, for the stretches that they would be running. And as I think about that there in closing, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 24, perhaps it is no surprise that the Apostle Paul uses this very analogy because the Corinthians would have been familiar with athletics and running and all of that with sport. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate or disciplined in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. And ladies and gentlemen, that should be our goal. That should be there within our heart. It's fantastic to look at biblical archaeology. It confirms that what we read in Scripture is true. It is verified. But more important, we need to understand that the evidence points us to Jesus as being the Christ. And He is the forerunner. And we need to be walking in His steps. And yes, as we run the race, let us be looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of God. Let's follow after Him as we run the race of life so that heaven can be our home. If you're not yet a Christian, we encourage you to become one this hour. Do not put it off. The gospel plan of salvation is very simple. It's very straightforward. Take care of your soul so that heaven can be your home. If you're subject to the invitation, come to the front where we stand now and sing.